Hi, I'm Dr. Barbara Byers, and today I'm going to talk to you about exploitative and abusive relationships and how we change them. And I'm going to do this in two parts. Exploitation and abuse, really, we can think of them as happening on a continuum, sometimes from mild to extreme. But these principles will apply, and it'll help to think about the situation differently. You may need to modify some things depending on your situation, but I hope this will clarify some of these situations. And really, there are three decision outcomes you have to consider. If you have been in an abusive, exploitative relationship, then something called a trauma bond has developed. And I would recommend Patrick Carn's book called Trauma Bonds, if you're interested in really exploring this in a deeper way. But a trauma bond is really an attachment, a bond or an attachment with someone who has betrayed or abused us. And sometimes we think, oh, just the exact opposite would happen. You know, if someone has come at me, if they've hurt me terribly, I'm not going to bond with them. But actually we do, because of the intensity of the relationship over a period of time. So the relationship is dysfunctional for sure, but it's very strong, and it is not at all easy to break away from or to change it. So that is our central decision. I'm going to change this. Something has to change. And sometimes a crisis is what provokes that, but that's our central decision. So when we decide something has to change, then really there are three decisions. So three decision outcomes. One is where we have no further contact with the person. So that could be a friend, a relative, an ex-partner in business or in love, something like that. And there is just going to be no further contact. The second is limited contact. And sometimes this is unavoidable. If you're divorced and have children with someone, a limited contact is unavoidable. So you have to learn in that venue, in those situations, what can I do to protect myself and to grow? The third situation is if both parties in this trauma bond, in this way that they have connected, attached, and related, want to reconstruct the relationship in a healthy way, want to learn new ways, and this takes an extraordinary amount of work, and both have to be fully committed to it. So here's how those three choices work. First is the path of no contact. This relationship is over, no question about it, and it's nothing can be redeemed from this. So first of all, you have to, with any of these, you have to have support. You have to get counseling, have a good therapist that knows how to work with the abusive relationships or exploitative relationships. And you know, sometimes these things can be so subtle. The subtler they are, the more difficult it is to recognize. And before we know it, we've been so diminished and don't even really understand why. So we get counseling, we join a therapy group, we join a 12-step group, and we develop new relationships. That's gonna be a key, is developing new relationships. Trauma bonds can be disruptive when new relationships begin to take their place, because now we learn healthier ways of relating to others. So finding supportive, healthy relationships is really foundational to our recovery and our restoration. And part of what needs to happen in these new relationships is we get a chance to tell our story. Telling our story, narrating the pain, learning to reframe it differently is essential in our healing. I was in the nation of Rwanda about 10 years after the terrible genocide in that nation. And one of the things that we did while we were there is we listened to so many stories. And I connected with a counselor who'd been trained by the Red Cross, and she had groups, and she had groups of women, and they had been raped by the soldiers. They were maimed. It was just, the horrors were unbelievable, but they had a chance to tell their story to each other. They had a chance to weep together. They had a chance for someone else to witness their pain, and that's absolutely essential. And she talked about how she would have to step back from it sometimes and take a little break, because she had to witness so many of the stories and so much pain. But when our isolation ends, then healthy bonding can begin. So AA was started by, you probably know, Bill W, I think, and Carl Jung, who was a psychotherapist, had written to him and told him, you know, change probably will not occur unless you give the alcoholics a way to tell their story and pass on their story. And that's how they built it so successfully. And so we have to break out of our isolation, humble ourselves, be vulnerable, and be willing to talk about that. So also, if we have support networks, they provide boundary developments and limits. A lot of times we're in these exploitative relationships because we haven't learned good boundaries ourselves. And we need to learn to be able to say, at least internally, I will not tolerate this anymore. I will not tolerate this anymore. We figure out what we don't want, what we just can't have in our lives, but also what we do want, and we move toward that. What we value, how we value ourselves. And God values us so much that it's essential that we learn not to let others diminish and devalue us, and to value what God values. So we must be really specific about what needs to change. We identify, you know, bottom line behaviors, non-negotiables, behaviors that you simply must not do or must do, and we're really specific about our boundaries and what we want in a relationship. Another thing is, for the bonds to be disrupted, the abused person or the exploited person needs to understand the cycles of abuse and needs to understand the roles. There's the victim, the abuser, and often the rescuer. And so understanding these things helps us be more objective. And the more objective we are, the more we can create psychological distance. Because in these relationships, that bond is so strong and so intense, we don't have objectivity and we don't have enough distance to step back and make good decisions. All right, the second choice is the path of limited contact. When we can't escape the contact for whatever reason, usually someone in the family or whatever reason, what do we do then? Well, the trauma bond, remember, is strong. And so we need help from other people who recognize it and help us stop being the victim even when we have contact with them. So like an example of this might be bookending. So you meet with someone who's supportive before you go into the contact with the person who tends to victimize you, and that inoculates you. And then after the contact, you can also do a debrief. What went well? What went wrong? What could I do different next time? And it really helps you see things more clearly and create limits and prevent ambushes and help you respond in the moment. We tend to, you know, either freeze up, I don't know what to say now, or, you know, we tend to be too aggressive. And so something like this can help prepare us and learn how to have better control over ourselves. And that is a fruit of the Spirit, by the way, our own self-control, our own self-governing over situations, especially really difficult situations. So victims can feel so much shame in situations. And the problem is, often our perpetrator is shameless. So we feel the shame, they're shameless, and then we end up carrying their shame too. And it really, victims are set up to devalue themselves, to diminish themselves, and they're set up to carry their shame. And a lot of times, by taking too much responsibility, what we're doing is we're really defending ourselves from having to examine what our abuser is actually doing to us and doing to the relationship. And we always feel at fault because we always feel responsible. But the only person we're responsible for is us and what we're doing in that relationship. And a good question to ask is, what am I doing? What am I even doing here? And what am I doing in the relationship? So one of the things we need to learn to develop strategies to de-escalate the intensity of what we feel, taking the intensity out, stopping some of the provocation, just keeping it when we do have to interact with someone, just kind of keep it a business as usual. What we do not ever do is give intimacy to the relationship again. Tell them things that maybe bear our heart emotionally, which gives them opportunity to use us again in that old connection. So we learn to reframe the interactions and look at them differently. So maybe when your father says something, you know, sarcastic, and then he says, "Oh, I was only joking," we tell ourselves, "No, no, that was cruel. That was mean." And we, you know, he's trying to connect with us, but in some sort of horrible, twisted way. And so the response is to tell ourselves the truth. Then we have some kind of a response to him. "No, that didn't feel like a joke to me. I'm going to go now." But we don't share our emotions. We simply share our boundaries. You know, "I'm not going to do this because I'm not going to be dragged back into what is a system. It's a system." And so you just can no longer tolerate certain things, even if you have to have limited contact with that person. Okay, the third thing is a path of full relationship. Now, this takes a lot of long, hard work. First, if there's addictions involved, they must be addressed. The abuser has to commit to a treatment program and recovery. Both of you have to be in therapy, but they have to be in a program of recovery. And every member of the support network has to be involved and kept up to date with what's happening. Another thing that's important, again, depending on the continuum of how mild or how terrible this is, often a period of separation is essential. It gives everybody breathing room. It gives everybody a chance to really look at the relationship and see what's happening. It gives especially the victim the experience of living separately, thinking separately, and of observing the abuser's choices. Are they really making progress? Is this real? And so on. And so if these conditions are met, then you can add other criteria. You can watch for a track record of non-abusive behaviors. Have they stopped yelling at me? Have they stopped calling me names? Have they stopped those subtle manipulations? Is there care for my soul? Or, you know, is there only care going one way? We can see if they're committed to the therapy. We can see if they've accepted responsibility for their abusive behaviors and are making amends and the things that are necessary. We can see if they've agreed to the zero tolerance of those things. And really, in that first year, that first period of separation, you don't make major decisions about the relationship. Because after a year, things are going to look differently. But once a new foundation begins to be built, then you can negotiate new things. One of the principal problems trauma victim have is their own reactivity. They're not objective. They're continually reacting. And so monitoring, if you're the victim, monitoring your own emotional responses is extremely important. And it's so easy to focus on the other person because that's what you've learned to do. You try to keep yourself safe by watching what they're doing. But it's really important to live in your own space and let God deal with your heart, and for you to take responsibility for the things you do that maybe make it too easy on your partner to victimize you or too hard on them to heal. So I want to close by just talking about this, and then we'll go into part two. So a healing metaphor, it really is remodeling, like remodeling a house. The first decision is, this place has really gotten to where it's almost falling down around our ears, and it's no longer sustainable. This relationship is no longer sustainable like this. In other words, you're coming out of your denial. And you're really looking at it and saying, this won't work. Then the second choice is you take on the remodeling decision. You got to be willing to pay the price for that. The work is unavoidable. Then you tear out. You assess the damage. What is anything salvageable? What can be kept? What needs to go in this original design? Then you start to rebuild, replacing the damaged parts, adding new ones, making things more functional, making the design more attractive. And then you still have to do upkeep so things don't fall into disrepair. So it's kind of helpful to think about it in that way. So, but for all three, recovery has to address some things: healthy bonds and healthy boundaries. Have to develop those. Have to change the role of a victim and abuser. Have to resolve the trauma, have to look at the whole system to see how it operates and change that. And then it is essential that the victim begins to develop their own sense of self, their own self, sense of who they are, and make a concrete recovery plan. Okay, next time we're going to go into part two and discuss a few more of these things. So I hope you'll stick with it.